I've always thought that train spotters get a rough deal. Seems to me they're sort of the late 20th century equivalent of somebody in the stocks. You know, comedians lob their rotten tomatoes of jokes about orange cagoules and the Tupperware box with the white plastic bread sarnies and the notebook and pencil and the Eva Beaver look at the end of a Clapham Junction station platform. Now, I've recently heard of a variation on train spotters. Apparently, the Channel Tunnel is going to be seventh heaven for a new group of people, lorry spotters. These apparently are people who not just spot lorries and say, oh, look, there's another big one. What they do apparently is crawl underneath lorries and note the chassis numbers and jot them down in their notebooks. And whereas previously all they've had really is motorway service station car parks in which to do their spotting, now they have the journey across the tunnel to go right the length of the train, lorry spotting. If I told you that we were going to spend this whole weekend looking at the issue of idle meat, well, I think you might well be tempted to feel that this is the Christian equivalent of a train spotter's weekend, or even worse, a lorry chassis number spotter's weekend. You know, something for the lonely hearts, for the weirdos. Sorry, apologies to all people who are lorry chassis number spotters here. I mean, idle meat isn't exactly the burning issue in the church today, is it? I was tempted to call the weekend idle meat a vital and much neglected question. Certainly would draw the crowds. I mean, at very best, it's obscure, isn't it? And I wonder whether, because it seems so obscure, these three chapters of 1 Corinthians that we're going to look at tend really to get looked over. I mean, we look at the first verse, now about food sacrifice to idols, and we go on to spiritual gifts in chapter 12. Or maybe chapter 11 and the women issue, but probably jump over that as well and go to chapter 12. But let me say that as I've studied these three chapters for this weekend, it's really made me think as I prepared, and made me think not just at the fascinating but irrelevant level. I've been gripped by it, and it seems to me in these chapters here is a message for St. Helens. And let me make it clear right at the beginning of this weekend that when I talk about St. Helens, I don't mean you as opposed to me, I mean us. I mean, I count myself within the broad category St. Helens in that I still look to St. Helens really as my sending church, my home church. So I still think of St. Helens as we and not as you as opposed to me. So whenever I say St. Helens, I don't mean you, not me, I mean us. But of course, if we're going to work out why it is that this is such a good message, a good theme, a good three chapters for St. Helens to be studying, we've got to go to Corinth first to understand what the issues were there. We're looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9 and 10. We're going to look at chapter 8 this morning. You'll need a Bible, definitely. So do take it and open it at chapter 8. And you'll see that the chapter begins with, "Now about food sacrificed to idols." And then again in verse 4, "So then about eating food sacrificed to idols." And it seems in this chapter, as he turns to this talk about this new issue of food offered or sacrificed to idols, he's replying to something that the people in Corinth have written to him about. Just flip back to chapter 7 and verse 1. And he says there, "Now for the matters you wrote about." And then he goes into the first one, chapter 7, sex or marriage or whatever chapter 7 is about. Then we turn to another one in chapter 8, food sacrificed to idols. Flick on to chapter 12. We get to another one now about spiritual gifts. Flick on to chapter 16 and we get to another one now about the collection for God's people. So at about chapter 7, verse 1, Paul seems to change in what he's writing and start replying to things they've written about. And it's because that's true that it's very important we work out what's going in Corinth. Because whatever it is Paul is saying here, he's responding to an issue there, something that they've written to him about. Either they've written to ask some question or to express some opinion. Corinth is a relatively new town. It's been rebuilt only about 100 years before this letter. And because of where it's placed, because of its geography, it was a large city. It had a population of about 100,000, about the size of Cambridge, which doesn't sound particularly large, but it will do if I tell you that Corinth was the second largest city in the Roman Empire, second only to Rome. So it's a big place. It's important, which I guess is why Paul gives it so much time in terms of visits and letters and so on. It's multicultural, cosmopolitan, all kinds of people are mixing together there. And the important thing about that for our study is that it's got a pluralist religious life. It's got lots of different kind of religious things going on. If you saw a photograph of Corinth at that time, it would be dominated by two huge temples on hills overlooking the city. But even more than that, more than just these two dominating the horizon, the whole town was stuffed full of small temples and shrines. They've excavated, for example, in one tiny area, about the size of a sort of village square, or maybe just a street along a village square, 15 to 16 different shrines in that one little stretch. There are hundreds of pagan shrines and temples. I was trying to think of the kind of equivalent in a town today. It's a bit, I guess, like the tobacconist, the sweet shop. You know how you can't walk along the street and you come across another one? It's like that, only more so. Corinth was stuffed full of them. So when in verse 5 of chapter 8, Paul says, even if there are so-called gods within heaven and earth, and then in brackets he says, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, he's talking about Corinth. That is what it was like, stuffed full of many gods, many so-called lords. And because there are all these different pagan shrines and temples and so on, sacrifices are getting made to the whoever it is that's getting worshipped or whatever in this shrine. Sacrifices are being made to them all the time. And of course, if you think about it, with so many gods, the quantity of meat that is getting sacrificed is absolutely enormous. And there's loads of sacrifices and there's masses of sacrificial meat knocking around in Corinth. And the question and the issue of these chapters is, can Christians eat that meat? But actually it's more complicated than that. At its most basic, that's the issue, but it's more complicated for three reasons. The first reason is that in these chapters, Paul's talking about eating that kind of meat in more than one situation. Just flick through this with me. If you look at verse 10 of chapter 8, if anyone with a weak conscience sees you have this knowledge, eating in an idol's temple. And what he's talking about there is actually taking part in a feast, in a pagan shrine or temple, that's part of the whole sacrificial thing. Actually eating that meat in that context. Now look on to chapter 10, verse 25. And he says, eat anything sold in the meat market. So we're talking about a meat not being eaten necessarily in there, but just bought over the counter. And then if you look on to verse 27 of chapter 10, if some unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go eat whatever's put before you, another situation, you're out to dinner at a pagan's home. And these are the three times in this chapter where Paul makes it clear where it is the idol meat is being eaten. And they're different situations. Okay, one is actually in the temple as part of a pagan feast. One is meat brought in the market. One is when you're out to dinner at the pagan's. And basically, to simplify this whole bit, if you've got a pencil or a pen, actually you better not do this because it might not be your Bible, there should be a thick line underneath chapter 10, verse 22. Because from 8:1 to 10:22, all of that bit, he's talking about the one situation of eating idol meat in the pagan temple as part of the sacrificial feast. And then from 10:23, the next bit, he's talking about these other situations, okay? So 10:22 is the big division. And all the way from 8:1 to 10:22 is the same situation. What that means for this weekend is that the whole of the first three talks, we're talking about that situation, and we don't get on to 10:23 following until Sunday morning. Okay, so all of today we're talking about idol meat in the pagan temple, part of the sacrificial thing. Tomorrow we go on to talk about the other situations. Okay, so that's the different situation. That's one reason why it's more complicated, because he's talking about more than one situation. The second reason why it's more complicated than that is this. I've tried to make a clear distinction between whether you're eating the idol meat in a temple or out of a temple. But actually, even that distinction is not quite so easy to make. See, in 10:25, when he talks about meat being sold in the meat market, actually most of the meat sold in the meat market would have come straight off the back of a temple. In other words, it's killed, it's slaughtered as part of the sacrifice. And then they got a good number going, it shifted out the back onto the stall and sold over the counter as meat. So in other words, when we're talking in 10:25 about meat sold in the meat market, actually even that meat has got pretty strong pagan connotations. More or less all the meat, any bit of mince, any lamb chop you went and bought in Corinth has got some kind of pagan association with it. And the other reason why it's a bit more complicated is that They've discovered in their excavations that loads of these temples, particularly the bigger ones, all around the kind of outside of a temple, they have little kind of restaurants or dining rooms. The sort of the equivalent of a gentleman's club, really. And so in 1027, where it's talking about, you know, if an unbeliever invites you to go to a meal, it's very likely that the invitation to a meal would be to come and have dinner with me at my club. My club being in one of these little private dining rooms stuck on the side of a temple. So even that eating meat there has that strong pagan idol worship connotation. Okay? So that's the second reason why it's more complicated. The third reason why it's more complicated, boy, is this complicated, is this, and I'm nearly finished, and then we'll get on to the passage. Third reason why it's more complicated is that poor people in Corinth wouldn't be able to afford to buy the meat that's being shifted out the back of the temple and sold over the counter. But obviously, they quite like to eat meat every now and then, even though they couldn't afford to buy it. And there are two ways they could get it. One, the first way doesn't really matter, but I'll just tell you what it was. The first way is in a kind of public distribution of meat. For example, some rich slob in Corinth might want to show off how wealthy he is, and so he offers to buy a meal for the whole city, which obviously would cost quite a lot of money. And he might do it maybe to celebrate some particular military victory, or perhaps a civic funeral, or at the games, for example, he might offer to pay for everybody to eat. In fact, this is my last bit of excavation. I'm not really interested in all this archaeology stuff, but it's sort of fascinating if you're into that kind of thing. Anyway, one of the things they've discovered in Corinth, right next to the theatre, is a cellar absolutely stuffed full of animal bones. And it seems that it's a kind of McDonald's, you know, on the way out of the theatre. You pick up your, whatever, leg of lamb. So that's one of the ways you could get meat, in this kind of public distribution. That doesn't matter, but the other way does. The other way you could get meat if you were poor is if somebody invited you personally to come and have dinner with them. So if, for example, you were in the aspiring middle classes and you got an invitation and you hadn't got enough money to buy meat yourself, but you got an invitation to go out to dinner at the temple or to go and join maybe your boss at a sacrificial feast in the temple, well, you wouldn't want to turn it down. It was a way of social climbing. It might actually be very important for your career to actually accept the invitation and go out with the person. Certainly it would be important for your kind of status and your position, how people would look at you. If you were seen eating meat in one of these things, or you were able to say to people next day, I had an awfully nice coq au vin last night, or whatever, everybody knows, ooh, got money to buy coq au vin. It's a sort of way of establishing, well, you know, I'm on the way up. So in other words, whether or not you ate meat might very well indicate where you are in the pecking order. So for those reasons, it's more complicated than it is. But for the sake of simplicity at this stage, let's come back to what the basic issue is from 8:1 to 10:22, and it's this. Could Christians eat idol meat as part of a sacrificial meal or feast in a pagan shrine? That is basically the issue we're looking at. And when we come to Corinth, basically there are two opinions amongst the Christians as to whether you could or couldn't. And I've represented these two opinions by two little people, somebody called Mr. Certain and somebody called Mr. Weak. You'll see in verse 11 that Paul talks about this weak brother, Mr. Weak, and what he thinks. And he's contrasting it in this chapter with what somebody else thinks. It's not like Romans, where there's a contrast between weak and the strong. He never really gives a name to the other people. And so I call them Mr. Certain for reasons that will become apparent in a minute. Mr. Certain, you see, was certain about particular things. He knew things. He was clear on them. And apparently Mr. Weak did not know those things. And knowledge is a very important word. Basically, that's what was dividing these Corinthian Christians over this issue. Some people knew something. They were Mr. Certain. Some people did not know something. They were Mr. Weak. Now, before we look at what it is that some of them did know and some of them didn't know, which I'm going to come on to in a minute, the main thing that Paul wants to say to this issue, to these two groups of people, comes at the end of verse 1. And he says this, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. That's the main thing that Paul is saying in this chapter. And I want to use that slogan of Paul's as the kind of basis for the talk. And we're going to do it in two halves. Knowledge puffs up, first of all, then secondly, love builds up. Knowledge puffs up is considerably longer than love builds up, except that love builds up goes on for the rest of the other two talks today. So in the end, it will end up being longer, but for the sake of this talk, it will appear shorter. Now, we've got to work out exactly what Paul means by these words, and what it is that some people know and what some people didn't know. So when he says knowledge puffs up, what it is he's talking about. The same way we've got to work out what he means by love. He uses it in a very specific way. It's not just, you know, love man. It's a particular thing he's got in mind. So we've got to work out what he means by those two words. But for now, that's what we're going to be looking at. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So first of all then, knowledge puffs up. What some Christians knew and what other Christians didn't know, that's what divides them into Mr. Certain and Mr. Weak. So what was it then that Mr. Certain knew? What was this knowledge? And the place to start is verses 4 to 6. And you'll be glad to know we're actually going to look at the Bible now. Verse 4 of chapter 8. What is it then that some people knew, Mr. Certain knew? So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know... Okay, here we get, this is the knowledge. We know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are in Corinth many gods, many so-called lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came, and for whom we live. There is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came, and through whom we live. So at the heart, then, of this knowledge of what it is that Mr. Certain knew, and Mr. Weak apparently didn't know, which we'll come into in a minute, at the heart of it is this great statement about God in verse 4. We know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. The RSV puts it in inverted commas to make it really clear. There is no God but one. And it may be that in quoting this, he's actually quoting from something that the Corinthians had written in their letter. And because it is that there is no God but one, any other God who's claiming to be a God is no God. An idol has no real existence. An idol is nothing at all in the world. So although verse 5 is true that there are many so-called gods, as there were in Corinth, yet they're nothing. There is no God but one. Now it may well be that you sort of half recognize that phrase, there is no God but one. It may sort of ring bells with you from the Old Testament. This great statement from the Old Testament, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That was the daily prayer for the Jews. They'd say it every day, even then as Paul was writing. It was almost like a battle cry for a nation that believed that its God was supreme in the world. Even if they felt small and insignificant, it was their battle cry. There is no God but one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. God is God. Our God is the God. There is no other. Now remember that phrase and look now at verse 6. And what Paul does in verse 6 is takes this phrase, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and explains it, or rather Christianizes it. Just look at verse 6 in detail. What he says, For us there is but one God. And then it's as if he's got as far as this word God in this prayer, and he explains what he means by God. Oh, by God I mean the Father, that God. The Christian's name for God, of course, to call God the Father. From whom all things came, that's what I mean by God the Father. You know, the fact that he's creator is what it is that makes idols nothing. They created nothing. They, in fact, just had to be made out of a bit of wood or stone. For whom we live. In other words, every part of our existence is for his purposes. That's what I mean by, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God. It is that God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live. The Lord... Oh, and by the way, by the Lord I mean... And he explains what he means at the end of verse 6. Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus is brought right into the heart of the Jews' prayer. The Lord is Jesus. He is the one through whom God created everything. He is the one through whom God redeemed. End of verse 5. Okay, so what's happening then in verse 6 is that Paul is taking that prayer and Christianizing it, making it absolutely clear what he means. Now, it's very tempting to take each of these six phrases, these three up here and these three down here, and talk a little bit about them and apply to these phrases. But I don't want to do that because I think it's more important to understand what is going on here in these verses. See, the statement, the prayer for the Jews, the thing they said every morning was, God is one. And what Paul is doing is bringing Jesus into that. He's saying, yes, there is no God but one. He is the Father and the Lord Jesus. Now, of course, after growing up with ideas of the Trinity, we don't find it at all surprising to be speaking in those kind of ways. But it is very surprising. One God, the Father, and Jesus. One God. It would blow the Jews' mind. Well, it did blow the Jews' mind. I mean, they tried to stone Jesus when he said, the Father and I are one. See, it's a foundation stone for the Jews. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. It took a revolution for a Jew like Paul to say, one God, the Father, and Jesus. It's an amazing statement in verse 6. And I want you to see how amazing it is to be saying these things, to make those statements in terms of the Jewish prayer. In other words, what's going on in verses 4 to 6, and this is the point of what I'm saying, what we've got here is mature, solid, dead sound Christian theology in verses 4 to 6. See, what Paul is saying, we know, this knowledge of Mr. Certain is grown-up Christian teaching. Let me make it even clearer. Mr. Certain here, who knows this, these things of verses 4 to 6, is a well-taught Christian. That's how we would describe him. You know, some Christians maybe haven't worked this out. It's the privilege of good teaching, Mr. Certain would say. We've got this clear. We understand this, we can articulate this, that Jewish prayer can be understood with Jesus at the heart. There is no God but one, the Father and Jesus. And so an idol is nothing at all in the world. And a slab of meat, well, it's just a slab of meat. It's just a slab of meat. Meat is meat. That's the thing that Mr. Certain has worked out. Idols are nothing. Meat is meat. We become clear on that. We're certain. Because we're well taught. We're mature Christians. But according to verse 7, some Christians don't know this. Maybe they're newer Christians. They haven't got this clear. Not everybody knows this. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol, and since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. And what he's saying there is, you see, they're so used to idols from their past, before they were Christians, that, well, now they just can't help themselves thinking in the way that they always used to think, that the idol was real, and that the meat was their meat. And they couldn't get it out of his mind that eating this meat was eating their meat. It was all to do with living for them and giving up your life for them and all kind of being involved with them and making them important. And, well, bless them, they didn't want to be idol worshippers now that they've become real Christians. Oh yes, they're real Christians, it's just that they're not well-taught Christians. So here is Mr. Week, and this is what he thinks, that idols are God, meat is their meat. He can't help himself from thinking now as a Christian as he used to think before he was a Christian. And this is the basic distinction between these two types of Christian in Corinth, these two different groups. The difference is to do with what they know, with their theology, how well-taught they are. But did you notice just a moment ago as I was describing what Mr. Certain would be saying about Mr. Week? Well, it's very difficult for poor Mr. Certain to be anything other than patronising about, poor Mr. Week. He hasn't quite got it yet. If only he'd had all the good teaching that I've had. If only the penny had dropped for him. You know, if only he could realise, if only he could share my knowledge. You see, it's very difficult for knowledge not to puff up. It fairly inevitably leads to pride. You know, Mr. Certain looking down on the person who, well, he doesn't know it yet. Who's still got wrong or immature ideas. I guess that most of you come to St. Helens for the teaching. You know, whatever your level of involvement, whether it's you just come along once a week to RML or something, or whether you're a member at St. Helens or whatever. You come basically to get taught. You enjoy the Bible being taken seriously in study, in explanation, in application. That's what attracted you to St. Helens. And it's great to sit under good teaching, isn't it? Now, this may not work if you're relatively new to St. Helens or you're still involved in another church or something, but I found it fairly easy to think of something where I'd changed my mind about something through being at St. Helens. You know, something that I'd thought previously in terms of belief, Bible teaching or whatever, but about which I came to think differently. Or to put it into this passage's terms, something which I came to know. I suppose the most obvious example, for me anyway, would be over the whole charismatic issue. But I don't want to use that as an example because that's a bit too obvious. I've got three other examples of areas in which I came to know things through being at St. Helens. First example. As I was mentioning last night, I used to be music director of a church in Croydon. And as part of my job, I used to do quite a lot of taking seminars and so on the subject of worship for other churches and conferences and so on, encouraging people to use music and the arts and so on. There were lots of things when I was doing that I used to think were very important. I used to even teach them as very important things, and which I came to see as less important. I mean, a silly example would be, you know, whether or not I lift up my hands when I'm singing a particular song or not, and how high I lift them up. Something over which I changed my mind. I came to know certain things. Second example. Again, while I was in Croydon, one of the things that I came to do quite a bit of was sort of trying to encourage a social conscience amongst Christians in Croydon over things like pro-life issues, things like abortion and so on, and nuclear weapons, that kind of thing. And was involved in sort of Bible teaching and so on, encouraging people into action, going on demonstrations, writing to MPs, joining pressure groups, that kind of thing. And again, through my time at St. Helens, through sitting under good teaching, I changed my mind about certain things, came to see certain things as less important, maybe still important, but not as important. I came to know something in this passage's terms. And the third example, and perhaps this is the kind of most obvious, is that I can think of a number of pretty embarrassing occasions as I look back now where maybe I was preaching from a particular passage, and now that I've done more work on a passage, well, I've come to realise that basically what I preached was completely up the spout. In other words, again, something where coming to study, sitting under good teaching, I've come to know certain things. In each of these examples, you see, I've come to know certain things through sitting under good Bible teaching. Now, thank God, the Bible's taught me, it's changed my thinking, it's revealed my error, and it's got me sorted out in a number of things. But two consequences have followed from that. One is that I come to look back on those things that I used to think as, well, silly, really, in a number of areas, certainly immature. You know, thank goodness I'm not like that anymore, and I've grown out of that. You know, in a sense, that's not wrong to look back and think, thank God I've grown. And it's good if it leads me to be thankful to God, leads me to be more humble about myself, you know, than I was a Wally, and probably still am. Definitely still am. It's bad, though, if as I look back and think how immature and so on, it leads me to be proud and think, I know better now. The other consequence is that I've noticed that I've come to look down often on people who still hold to those views that I used to think were important and I now have changed my mind about and now think I know better. Poor them, I think. You know, they don't know better. They are a bit silly, a bit immature. It certainly seems to be the case that knowledge puffs up. How easy for the knowledge we've gained through good Bible teaching to puff us up. How easily we look down on those who don't know. How easily Mr. Certain looks at Mr. Weak and thinks, Mr. Wimp. And looks at himself and thinks, Mr. Super Christian. And it seems to me this is right up St. Helen's Street, isn't it? We are a church that rejoices in good teaching. We do know things. We do have knowledge. We are a knowledge church, if you like. Like Mr. Certain, our good doctrine has led to clear thinking, sharp black and white conclusions. Thank God for it. We need more of it. But beware. Because knowledge puffs up. Watch out for Mr. Weak. Don't despise the weaker Christian, the less well-taught Christian, the Christian who goes to whichever church it is you regard as, well, a bit silly, a bit immature, a bit frothy or whatever. And this is especially important, isn't it, for those who are planning to leave St. Helens and looking to go somewhere else. How easily knowledge puffs up so that we look down on Mr. Weak. But just come back to Corinth again with me, because we haven't got quite as far as we should in our understanding of what's going on in this chapter. And will you look again at verse 7, the verse I read just now. Not everybody knows this. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat... Hang on a minute. He doesn't say some people are so accustomed to idols that if they were to eat such food, then they would think of it. He's more describing something that's actually happening. He's not talking about a hypothetical situation. When they eat such food, that's how they think. In other words, what seems to be going on is that Mr. Weak is actually eating what he thinks he shouldn't be eating, what he thinks it's wrong for him to be eating. Now, why is he doing that? Why has he got himself into the situation why he would actually start to eat things, knowing that he doesn't want to, that it's wrong? Well, the clue, I think, is in verses 9 to 10. Let's have a look at those. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom doesn't become a stumbling block to the weak. And it seems, you see, that Mr. Certain was so sure of verses 4 to 6. He's certain his theology is sound. His good teaching leads him to be sure there's nothing whatever wrong with eating. So he's going right ahead and eating the idol meat, right in front of Mr. Weak. And now, verse 10. If anyone with a weak conscience sees you who have this knowledge eating in an idol's temple, so if Mr. Weak sees Mr. Certain eating, won't he be emboldened to eat what has been sacrificed to idols? Now, that little word there, won't he be emboldened, or if you've got the RSV, won't he be encouraged to eat, that is the word built up or edified. It's always used elsewhere of Christians being built up, being edified towards Christian maturity. And this, I think, is the one place in the New Testament where new Christians may be built up, where Christians, not necessarily new Christians, where Christians may be built up, edified, to do what they think is wrong. And it seems that what was going on is that Mr. Certain was saying something like this to Mr. Weak. We used to think as you do. Even when we became Christians, you know, we couldn't help but think of idols as gods and idol meat as sacrifice to them as gods. But we've understood the Bible better now. We've got our doctrine of God clearer. You see, idols are nothing. Meat is meat. Knowing this is the path to Christian maturity. If you want to show you're a really mature Christian, a grown-up Christian, even a proper Christian, well, you'll eat meat like us. You see, eating meat, well, that's just living out the truth about God. It's shouting to the world, idols are nothing. There is no God but one. And you want to shout that to the world, don't you? Don't you see? If you want to grow up as a Christian, you'll join us. Come and eat some of this meat. Eating could edify you. It could build you up, Mr. Weak. In fact, it seems that their slogan might have actually been, knowledge builds up. In other words, knowing the truth about God can make you a mature Christian, so that these things don't matter to you. It becomes entirely irrelevant whether we eat or not. It just doesn't matter. And what Paul has done is taken this slogan and he's upturned it. Knowledge builds up, you say? No, knowledge puffs up. Look at yourselves. Knowledge has puffed you up. Look at yourselves, St. Helens. Knowledge builds up? No, knowledge puffs up. And he launches into this knowledge. And there's three things he has to say about it to show that knowledge isn't everything. And we're going to look at those three things. Although it has more lines on the notes, it moves faster now. First of all, then, as he launches into the knowledge, the first thing he says is what we know is incomplete. Verse 2. The man who thinks he knows something doesn't yet know as he ought to know. Paul wants us to realise however much we think we know, we don't know it all. And that's a very important thing for us to get into our heads, isn't it? This side of heaven, we don't know the whole story. God has told us everything we need to know, but that doesn't mean he's told us all there is to know. And this is a much bigger problem in Corinth than just this little verse. And it seems that there were lots of areas where they'd upgraded their experience of now and so downgraded heaven, as if now is the fulfillment of all that God is doing. And of course, there are lots of areas in the church today where Christians similarly treat now as if all there, now is all there is. You know, an obvious example would be expecting God always to heal every sickness. But rather than apply this to others, let this hit home to us, will you? Isn't there a danger in the way that we think about what we know as well-taught Christians? Don't we often feel we've got some doctrine sussed? I'm not talking here about controversial things. Usually in those kind of areas, we're happy to accept we're not quite sure, haven't got it sussed. But often those areas, those very areas where we look down on other Christians. In fact, isn't that often the reason why we look down on other Christians? Because we know what is what over this, and you don't. And there's something we urgently need to hear here. What we know is incomplete. Shouldn't stop us being certain, because the Bible will lead us to convictions. God has given us all we know so that we can be sure, but it should stop us being proud. It just keeps us and our knowledge and our opinion of ourselves in our place. In fact, for now, more important than what we know is verse 3. The man who loves God is known by God. See, who knows us is far more important than what we know. On the last day, will God say, I never knew you, or will he welcome me home as a son? God knowing me is far more important than the opinions I reach on A or B or C. So that's the first thing that Paul says about their knowledge. What we know is incomplete. The second thing he says is what we know can be contradicted when we insist on it. Now there's a memorable little heading for you, isn't it? Look at verse 8. Food doesn't bring us near to God. We're no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. Let me just read that again. Just stick with it. Verse 8. Food doesn't bring us near to God. We're no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. And who's Paul speaking to here in verse 8? Well, at first glance, it appears that he's speaking to Mr. Weak. He's the one who needs to be told that what we eat doesn't bring us near to God. In other words, idle meat is irrelevant. Seems that verse 8 is addressed to him. But actually, the more you look at it, it's Mr. Certain who thought that we're worse if we do not eat. You see, he thought if we refuse to eat, well, it looks like we're saying the idol is real and that the meat is their meat. It was Mr. Certain who thought we're actually better if we do eat, because it advertises that we think idols are nothing. It advertises our Christian maturity. In fact, it was Mr. Certain who thought that food brings us near to God. He thought it was Christian maturity, living out our doctrine of God, the application of good teaching to eat idol meat. It's Mr. Certain who needs to be told, verse 8, that food doesn't bring us near to God. We're no worse if we do not eat. We're no better if we do. Of course, if you went up to Mr. Certain, Mr. Well-taught Christian, and said, you know, food doesn't bring us near to God, he'd say, I know that. In fact, that's why he felt free to eat idol meat. It didn't affect his relationship with God at all. Food didn't, had nothing to do with it. He knew Christians were free to eat or not to eat. It didn't matter. But don't you see that what had happened was this? By putting all the pressure that he'd put on Mr. Weak, by forcing Mr. Weak to eat, he'd made an issue out of it. You see, he'd not just said, idle meat is irrelevant, it doesn't matter whether you eat or not. He'd said, idle meat is so irrelevant, you must eat it. Okay? He knew that food doesn't bring us near to God, but by insisting that others ate it, he'd said food does matter. He said it's the way to Christian maturity. You're closer to God if you do eat. In other words, he's contradicted the very thing he knows by insisting on it. Now, although this may seem rather convoluted and complicated, actually it's dead important. Take, for example, all the stuff over women's ordination in the Church of England at the moment. You know, whatever you think about women's ordination itself, which I'm not going to go into now, lots of us have become concerned that it seems to be being made, or have been made, an article of faith in the Church of England. You know, you can't be ordained if you don't agree with women's ordination. Certainly you can't become a bishop. And we want to say, look, women's ordination is not a gospel issue. It shouldn't be used as the marker of how sound somebody is. But there's a danger here, and it's this. You see, we can so insist that women's ordination is not a gospel issue that we start to say you're only really sound if you agree with us over women's ordination. In other words, we've made women's ordination a gospel issue by insisting that it's not. You get that? So we've contradicted what we think we know by insisting on it. Or a much more trivial example. You know, I'd want to say that whether or not I lift up my hands when I'm singing a particular song is irrelevant. But what if somebody were to do it at St. Helens? I know, hold on to your seats. A tricky moment here. This will get censored out of the tape. I know of two occasions when I was at St. Helens when somebody did it. I know more occasions when people did it. But these two occasions, I know when somebody lifted up their hands and another person near them said, we don't do that kind of thing here. In other words, do you see what they're saying? Lifting up your hands is so irrelevant, you shouldn't do it. They're saying not lifting up hands matters. You're closer to God. You're more mature if you don't. In other words, the very truth you know is contradicted when you insist on it. Third thing then that Paul says as he launches into what it is that the Mr. Certain was saying he knows, it's this: what we know can foul up. In other words, it is the church that gets fouled up, or certainly it was in Corinth. Three things here. First of all, how the church gets fouled up is that Mr. Weak is destroyed. Look at verse 9. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom doesn't become a stumbling block to the weak. Verse 11. So then this weak brother of whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. Destroyed is not simply, you know, he'll be a bit put out by it. He'll be offended by it. The word is very strong, very deliberate. Paul is talking about eternal loss, hell instead of heaven. You know something, you act on it and insist that others do, and those others are hell-bound as a result. Why this is so, Paul doesn't say here, and he's going to say why in chapter 10. We'll come back to that. But the point here is simply this, that the stakes in this issue are as high as they possibly could be. Mr. Weak is destroyed. Secondly, the church gets fouled up because Mr. Certain sins against Mr. Weak. Look at verse 12a, beginning of verse 12. When you sin against your brothers in this way and wound their weak conscience, to act in the way in which Mr. Certain was acting, to mess with the eternal destination for Mr. Weak, that's sin. Paul is simply saying, look what you're doing with your knowledge. It's not building up, it's sinning. It's doing wrong to another Christian. And thirdly, what we know can foul up the church because Mr. Certain sins against Christ. Look at the end of 12. When you sin against your brothers in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. See, to destroy a brother for whom Christ died, to sin against Mr. Weak, to bring this kind of sin and destruction into the church, is to sin against Christ. You see, not only does knowledge puff up, it fouls up the church. Paul doesn't mince his words here. He's really laying into them, isn't he? Mr. Certain is insisting idol meat. It just doesn't matter. It's an irrelevance. But what he's doing, according to Paul, is a first-class demolition job on other Christians. And it's offensive to the Lord Jesus. Now just get this line, will you? It begins with sound theology in verses 4, 5 and 6. And it ends with people on their way to the hell and the Lord Jesus repulsed. Knowledge puffs up. But you ought to be asking, hang on a minute, isn't knowledge, isn't growth in knowledge the mark of the Christian? I mean, why on earth do we slog to understand the Bible, to do RML prep, to listen to those long sermons at St. Helens and make all these notes? That's because truth matters, isn't it? Knowledge is important. And yes, it is. Yes, it is. Knowledge, what we know, being well taught, does matter. But the point is this, knowledge isn't the end of the matter. It isn't the end of the story. We will tend to treat knowledge as the mark of the Christian. How much we know, how sound is our theology? Well, that's what shows our maturity. That's why we look down on Mr. Weak, the less well-taught Christian, the new, the immature Christian. And the question is, what will we do with what we know? Yes, it matters that we know, we grow in knowledge, but what will we do with what we know? Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Love builds up, then, secondly. What does Paul do with what he knows? Well, he's just explained in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12 the real danger. Verse 10 might happen. Mr. Weak might be built up to eat idol meat. But rather than being built up, actually, he's become a building into which the bulldozers have moved to demolish. By eating, he's destroyed. He's hell-bound. So what does Paul do, knowing the real danger of verses 9 to 12? He does verse 13. Therefore, this being the case, this being the danger, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so I'll not cause him to fall. If what I eat can lead to the disaster of verses 9 to 12, I'll change my eating pattern. In fact, I'll go to whatever extreme is necessary. See, in verse 13, he's not just talking about idol meat. He uses a different word when he says, I'll never eat meat again. It's the normal word for any meat, not the special word for idol meat that he's been using in this chapter. He says, I'll become veggie rather than risk verses 9 to 12. And he says it in a very strong way. He says, I will never eat meat forever. Ever. I'll cut out the whole caboodle. Forget it. Why? Because real building up is what matters. And my brother being destroyed is so awful. So I'll act in this way. And that is what he means by love in verse 1, when he says love builds up. What he means by love is defined by verse 13. I will act in the verse 13 way, for that builds up. And behavior like verse 13 is what shows Christian maturity. Love like that. Knowledge, what I know, being well taught, that's not the mark of Christian maturity. It's love. Love is defined in verse 13. A concern for my fellow Christians' salvation. That kind of love. You know, we come to an issue and we want to know, is it right or wrong? Should I do it or shouldn't I do it? You know, that's the issue we're going to spend the whole of today wanting to know what Paul thinks about idol meat as these chapters go on. He's not going to get to the answer to that question for ages. Paul asks a different question first, a much more important question than is it right or wrong. Apart from what is right and wrong, he says, what will be the result of my behaving in a certain way? And if it's sin, it can't be right. Paul hasn't finished with the issue of idol meat. He's going to come back to it in chapter 10. And actually, he's going to make clear in the end that eating it is wrong with a capital W. But at this point, that was supposed to be a joke. Spelling mistake, wrong. Just to check with me. But at this point, he's taking what they're saying at face wrong. R actually begins with a W. Apart from is it right or wrong, at this stage, he's looking at the effect. And he's saying, if Mr. Week ends up in hell, how can you insist on your knowledge? How can this knowledge be mature Christianity? Now look, this is very important for us. St. Helens is a church renowned for good teaching. It's a church which, if you like, prides itself on knowledge in a good way. But have you not heard the criticism, something like this? You know, St. Helens is good for teaching, but there's no support, there's no practical love. Whether this is an accurate criticism is not my point. My point is a comment like that should ring alarm bells loudly to us. This chapter makes it clear we should beware. Knowledge, that's not the mark of maturity. Knowing more is crucial. But what are we going to do with our knowledge? Love is the mark of maturity, a love that builds up, whereas knowledge puffs up, according to verse 1. Now, as I said at the beginning, I've skipped over this love builds up bit because chapter 9 is going to work out the practicalities of this love. And I just want to end with a couple of practical examples. Whilst I was at Ridley, I wrote a communion service, the kind of order of service, the liturgy and so on, for doing a communion. I wanted to write it in an Anglican way and so write it that there was no possibility of anybody who was there thinking that anything had happened to the bread and wine. You know, that it didn't change into body and blood as, you know, higher church people would think it had done. And we used this communion service that I'd written as part of a college communion whilst I was at Ridley. Another student brought along a friend of his who was a monk, a friend who is well up the candle. And as the monk left, he was heard to say this. As far as I'm concerned, he said it angrily as well, actually. Yes, as far as I'm concerned, it started off as bread and wine, and it was still bread and wine at the end. And I thought, yes, I've done it. I've achieved what I intended. The whole aim was that was what you should think. It has worked. It is possible to write a communion service with no confusion. Even somebody who wants to think something had happened to it still thought it was bread and wine at the end. Yes! Now, whether it not is that I was right or wrong, and I'm right and wrong on my theology of communion, I'm sure I'm right. The point is this. I was much more concerned to force my knowledge down somebody else's throat than the salvation of that monk. Of course I'd offended him. This passage isn't simply about offending people. It's what happens to them ultimately that matters. And as I studied this passage, I thought I have not given one moment's thought to the salvation of that monk since that day. Just didn't care. I was just glad that I'd forced my knowledge down his throat. Knowledge mattered to me, love did not. And because I think I know, I consider myself mature. A second example. Suppose as a Christian, because of your cultural background, You've always engaged in social drinking. And you leave St. Helens and you move to a church which, if you like, is socially more conservative. And one of the elders of that church, that is more socially conservative, and would the Christians there generally would not drink, sees you drinking at a party and comes up to you and says, "I have to tell you, I'm offended by your drinking. Paul tells us that if anyone is offended by what you do, you must stop. I'm offended, therefore you must stop." Well, how would you respond? Well, the first thing to be clear about is that this is not a 1 Corinthians 8 situation. He's not Mr. Weak. He's not about to be swayed to do what he considers is wrong. I should think he sees himself as the stronger Christian. And if he catches you again, no doubt he'll denounce you again. He's simply manipulating you. Now, 1 Corinthians 8 situation would be more like this. You start to run the youth group at this same church. And lots of the young people come from these socially conservative homes. They've grown up with a clearly developed conscience over drinking, believing that drinking is wrong because they've always been taught it's wrong by their Christian families. They see you drinking at a party and they start to copy. And in time they become sloppy about all kinds of moral issues because they think, from what they've seen you doing, that those kind of things, the kind of Christian morality that they've been taught since childhood, doesn't really matter. Love builds up, says Paul. And what Paul means by that is verse 13. The mature Christian, you see, would never drink again. What about you, RML leaders, with new Christians in your group? Christians from different backgrounds. Maybe Christians from backgrounds very like that. Are there areas where you're so clear on what is right and wrong that knowledge matters more than love? If you're an RML leader, giving up alcohol may actually be a very wise thing to do whilst you're an RML leader. Or forever, I'll never drink again, verse 13. And a third example, and my last one, and it really carries on from above. I grew up in a strong Christian home, I guess very like those homes that I was just describing, socially conservative, very clear taboos on what Christians do and don't do. Cinema was frowned at. I remember being taken to the Jungle Book. It was all sort of slightly naughty that I was being taken to the Jungle Book. My parents still don't watch TV on a Sunday, and they wouldn't ever. An important part of my growing up, as I was trying to describe last night really, was establishing what I thought about Christian faith, and therefore as well about what was right and wrong, drawing my own lines for what was godly behaviour. And I changed considerably from my parents. I suppose I grew up into a theology that I guess addresses every area of life. You know, the kind of no secular, no sacred division in your Christian life. You know, I could enjoy life, I could have fun, I could go to the cinema, I could be involved in the arts and so on. But I think there were two consequences that came from that. One of them was that I think in many areas I overstepped the mark. I watched films, read books that weren't helpful. Very interesting, actually, while I was writing this talk, my son, Charlie, caught me reading a book that was sort of dodgy. Now you're all wondering what kind of dodgy. It wasn't that kind of dodgy. And he said, "Daddy, that book's just full of swearing." And others, seeing that, my behaviour, I guess, may well have copied and been led into sin. People I don't know about. Charlie, maybe, seeing me reading that. And another consequence is that I came, I think, in many ways to regard that being involved in those kind of things, a knowledge of arts, of films, of novels or whatever, they were sort of marks of Christian maturity. You know, if you knew about the latest film, well, it showed that you were in that same kind of theological freedom that I'd discovered. You know, kind of no secular, sacred division. You were a sort of mature Christian too. You know, those with the hang-ups of my upbringing, well, they were sort of immature. This may not ring bells for you, but there's a lot of this thinking around, I think. You know, how did you respond to that story just now about alcohol? What did you think when I said what that elder said, imaginary elder, had said to you at a party? Did you think, "Oh, silly, nitpicking, old-fashioned, he's immature, I'm mature"? Knowledge puffs up, love as defined in verse 13. That type of love builds up. I've nearly finished. At the end of each talk, I put a little kind of PS, a sort of soap opera cliffhanger to keep you hanging on so you can't wait for the next episode. You see, you may well be thinking, well, hang on a minute, isn't this kind of attitude going to lead to total inconsistency? You know, I might think that something is actually okay, it's right, but then I end up not doing it. You know, I might think, for example, idol meat is okay, but then for a verse 13 reason, I don't eat it. Surely this is totally unprincipled. If it's right, it's right. We must live by our principles, surely. And it seems that some were saying this about Paul, that his behaviour showed a complete lack of principle. Verse 13, you see, raises Paul as an example. This is what I'll do. And chapter 9 must answer this criticism that Paul seems to have no principles at all. And what he's going to say in chapter 9 is, yes, there's a very important principle which can control it all of a Christian's living. It is principled. And that's what we're going to come and look at next time. Now, I've suggested that after each talk, we go into nitty-gritty groups for a few minutes, not very long, and I've worked out some kind of discussion questions for us to use in these groups. I've gone on a bit now, so we haven't got very long. We'll have to work out what we're going to do about timing. You can think about that while I'm waffling on. And really what we're going to do in these is to begin to think through some of the implications each time. Obviously, we can't do all the thinking. Obviously, the thinking that is required from studying the Bible, you know, is something you've got to find time and do. But just to take it the next stage of making us verbalise some things, to start saying, that really struck me. I realise I've got to change in that area. I've got to do some thinking about that. I'd never really thought about that. That's interesting. I've got to think that through a bit. Now, to start to verbalise that to somebody else actually begins to build in some sort of accountability as you listen to talks, doesn't it? It actually gives somebody else the right to you to come back to you in a fortnight's time and say, you know, you said that. What are you going to do? What have you done about that? Have you done the thinking yet? And it'd be very good, wouldn't it, if there's that kind of thing going on between us. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go into these groups. There's a sheet of questions. Well, I'll put on the chair there. So as you go out through the door, pick one up. And Justin will tell us which groups we're going in, where we're going to, and how long we got.